The Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast brought to you by LL Pavorsky Jewelers, where Rights to Ricky Sanchez listeners go and get engaged. SeatGeek, get $10 off your first order with promo code RTRS, promo code RTRS. And Kinetic Skateboarding, get 9.1% off your first order with promo code Dave Silver. On the show today, Furkan Korkmaz timeline. Wanted to get traded because he wasn't getting any playing time last year. They sort of laughed. They didn't pick up his rookie option. He became a free agent. Nobody wanted to sign him. The Sixers couldn't find anybody else. They re-signed him. He's playing 20 minutes a night, and he hit the most exciting game winner since Spencer Hawes the other night. Really, just it's an unpredictable timeline for Furkan Korkmaz. So we will talk about that shot and that game. And another, I will tell you, the mailbag people are coming through enormously. So a couple of good mailbag questions. Tickets for two-way night at the Blue Coats with the Rights to Ricky Sanchez. For $14 ticket, you get the Blue Coats game, the mini live Ricky on the court after the game, the co-branded Blue Coats and Rights to Ricky Sanchez t-shirt, Dollar Dog Night, and more surprises on the way. Go to rightstorickysanchez.com for info on how you get the promo code. Or you just go to sixers.com/bluecoats and use promo code Ricky. Just go to our website. I forget. And our new t-shirt is for sale now. We're going to do a reprint of the Al Horford shirt soon. And the shirt is coming back for a very special one weekend offer only. So that is coming up soon.
We're like the Disney Vault.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you can subscribe to Rights Ricky Sanchez Plus. 3 years is only $7.99
if you sign up. It's all my content. It's just me, yeah. My dumb shorts that I did 15 years ago.
The Grinder? Is the Grinder on there?
Sure, the Grinder can be on there. I'll talk sure. to 20th and see if we can arrange a deal.
Without any further ado, here is Amos and the Chef.
Larry, sweetie, the man is here.
Say the name. I say the name. I say the name.
We will write y'all.
Welcome to the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast. I'm Spike Eskin, along with a guy who just must be floating on the air after that Furkan Korkmaz game winner. That is Mike Levin.
It's been an eventful five games.
Mm-hmm.
There hasn't been
a normal game.
A normal
just
game
a normal win.
Of the bunch.
Well, was Detroit a normal win? I can't even remember.
I guess. I mean,
Embiid
had just gotten hurt.
Yeah,
and was sitting a precautionary game, so we went right into load management. It's been interesting. I haven't watched many of the games live because of work, and I was dog sitting this weekend, and so went out with some friends on that side of town. So I was going to watch it later. But when something crazy happens, and I get a bunch of texts that just say Korkmaz, I kind of know something
what happened?
Went down.
Yeah.
And so when I got a chance to watch it this morning, it was daylight savings, and so I woke up what I thought was a different time. I thought I woke up at 6 in the morning to watch a fucking Sixers game, and a Korkmaz Sixers game. Happy Sunday to me. But really, what a delightful time. I'm so surprised that they won that game. If I did not know that they had won that game, it would have been a much more painful viewing experience for me. I'll tell you that.
There are some days where watching the game on delay is better, and there are some times when it isn't. In this case, it wasn't, because it really did steal a lot of the joy. It was funny. So I was away this weekend to go to a concert with my brother, and then we went to dinner afterwards. But after the place the concert was, there was no cell signal. So we got out of there, and I have a like the tweets, nobody was telling me what was happening. It was just names. So it was like, who's the, what's his name that I like? Hazonia. So first there were a bunch of just people tweeting Hazonia at me. And then a bunch of people tweeting Anfernee Simons at me.
Sure.
And then just a bunch of people tweeting Korkmaz Emergency Pod. So yeah.
You can put it together. Yeah, what a start by Hazonia, by the way. Really fun.
Oh, God. Yeah. He is so big, you know? He's bigger than... I will go to my grave saying that the Euros on YouTube are different people than the people that actually get here.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, he could play
something
four
happens
almost.
In customs that changes...
Yeah, they get bigger and slower.
Or shooting, yeah. Or just the way they... Anything. I will say there's an interesting thing because Ben had Hazonia on him for a while and it was like, oh, he's going to roast him. But NBA defenders, for the most part, if they're not like size deficient or just mm-hmm. tremendously slow-footed laterally, everybody can body up pretty yeah. much. Like it's the yeah. reason Hazonia is a bad defender isn't because if a guy is posting him up, he can't bang. It's because he gets lost off ball and can't quickly react to schemes in that sense. And that's, I think, for the case for most bad defenders. And so I think a lot of times you see, oh, I got a big mismatch on him, so I'm just going to, you know, bang the shorter guy because he's not a typically good defender. And usually that's not always the case.
Yeah, and if Ben doesn't have a size advantage or can't, like, you know, Hazonia's a big guy, and it's difficult for you know, Ben to just sort of, like, overpower him, or mm-hmm. and he's not super slow. So Ben can have trouble with a guy. One of the best things about Ben is that there's so many mismatches physically for him that he can take advantage of. And the Hazonia one is sort of a weird mismatch.
And sometimes if you think you have a mismatch and it's not, like, paying off, then that sort of yep. derails the whole offense, which I think was kind of some of the problem in a good chunk of the game, first half at least.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that happens when little guys get big guys switched onto him a lot. Because a lot of times the big guy will just stand there, and when the smaller guy can't get by him, he's determined to take a shot, even if it's not a good shot. Mm-hmm. I think that happens a lot. all right, before we get to the game, the five-star review, which is brought to you by the Apple Podcast five-star review, brought to you by Kinetic Skateboarding. I bought these Mischief Knight New Balances, these New Balance Numerics, which are like the special New Balances that only skate shops get. They're orange, and they have a little jack-o'-lantern on them, limited, sold out right away. And then I realized they were leather, which I don't wear, so I think I'm just going to raffle them off for some charity.
Do you know that Mischief Knight is only a thing in the Philadelphia area?
Well, it's only a thing in the Northeast. I don't think it's only Philly,
no,
right?
No, it's just like Philly and Jersey. Like, it's not... There's
really?
There was something on Twitter I saw where it was like, what do you call the night before Halloween? And a bunch of the country says, I have no term for that. And
it's
just
nothing?
Philly and Jersey. Yeah. It's just Philly and Jersey. And, like, in Michigan, it's called, like, the Devil's Night or something like that.
I like it better, then. I like
it's
it
so
better.
So bizarre. It had to happen. I always wonder how these things come to be. But it had to happen, like, some, like, high school in... Like
yeah.
the 50s probably had like one night that they called it Mischief Night, and like it made the news or the papers or something, and then it just became that for the entire area. Very bizarre.
KineticSkateboarding.com, 9.1% off your first order with promo code Dave Silver. Mike, this comes from Rachel H2P96. I was once a loyal girlfriend of the pod who simply humored my boyfriend's need to listen on long car trips and followed along with Sixers Twitter, thus enabling Andrew's childlike zeal and passion for the squad pod. Andrew, I guess her boyfriend. That has since changed, and I've become a diehard myself. In the time since, I've convinced Andrew going to a Sixers game is the only appropriate way to celebrate our anniversary, bought a Joel Embiid prayer candle, and have done a deep dive on Matisse Thybulle's social media to find evidence to support my theory that he is possibly the second coming of Jesus Christ. Yes, his old content is exactly as pure as you would expect. My current mission is this: help me convince Andrew that we must attend Fly the Process. I'm hearing a lot about the practicality right now, and I need to get him on board. I figured this might be my best shot. Thanks, guys. Love the pod.
I want to hear, and you can talk about Fly the Process to Indiana, but mm-hmm. I want to know if there is, because I'm sure people get their significant others into the podcast or whatever podcast they listen to a lot, but when they break up, I want to know if, like, if you guys are still listening separately? Like, is there, or is there ownership of it? Are we lost in the breakup at some point? Do we get sort of as friends get broken apart and say like, okay, yeah, you get these friends, I get these friends. Does someone get the Ricky? I'm not listening to that anymore. I can't do it.
Well, and if it's a bonding experience like this, is it just like bad vibes all around?
Maybe.
Like, you know,
we're fucking caught in the snowball in the storm. I want to hear about it. So if that's happened where you've broken up with someone that introduced you to the podcast, do you still listen to the podcast? Please reach out to us. Thank you.
Rachel, here is the sell that I give everyone, and it is an honest sell, and I believe it, and I used it on my wife, and it worked like wonders. I was shocked at how easy it was. Here's what I always say about the New Year's Eve trip, because it is to Indianapolis. We'll go to the game at 3, and then the all-inclusive New Year's Eve party that night, and TJ comes to the party. Two nights, great trip. Always the fans of Philly trips are always great. Here's my sell. New Year's Eve. Here is how it goes in my house, and I feel like how it goes in a lot of people's houses. Unless a close friend is having a party, you spend like 2 weeks trying to figure out what you should do. You like go on the internet, you end up going to dinner at 6 o'clock or 6:30, you're home by 9 o'clock, and then you try to stay up until midnight. Like, to me, New Year's Eve is like a really young person's thing where you're going crazy on New Year's Eve. So you don't really have any plans anyway. And once you're, Indianapolis is not like the party capital of the world, but once you're in a place, what difference does it make? So I would say, and this is what my wife said to me, like, if it's one New Year's Eve that you have this cool story and like TJ was there and it was a bunch of weirdos in a bar in Indianapolis, you went to a Sixers game that day, you saw a Sixers game, the best team in the NBA. Like, there are so many worse ways New Year's Eve could go. It's a fun idea. Would I say that you should do it every year? No. But would I say that this is one good story that you could have in your New Year's Eve like history with you and your boyfriend? Absolutely. So I think you should go. And it's an all-inclusive like party, and the hotel is right across the street, so you can drink as much as you want as long as you're not driving. So just have a regular fucking New Year's Eve time there as well. So there's my sell.
There
so do you want to work backwards with the Blazers game and go Korkmaz from to the beginning, or how do we do
smart.
This?
I think we should start with Korkmaz.
Boy. So it was a fabulously run play is what I would say. And upon watching it a few times, the thing that really sticks out, I would imagine to you as well, is the Horford screen on Lillard was perfect.
Come on.
And it gave Korkmaz the exact amount of time he needed. Because really, Lillard made up that space in a very quick amount of time. When you watch the replay, he's right there. And that screen to set him free was perfect. It was a perfectly run play. It was such balls to call it for fucking Korkmaz. I guess who else are you calling it for? But he's the best shooter on the team. I don't know, man. It's such a, there's so many wonderful things about the shot. His reaction, unbelievable, total shock, had no idea what was going on. Just wonderful.
Do you think do you really think that he was the first option on that play?
Yep.
I'm going to watch it again.
Yeah. I don't know, because they only had 4 seconds.
2 seconds.
2 seconds, right? It was 2.2, right?
Yeah.
So I think it was. I don't know what else, unless there was something that, because remember, Ben, unless there was something that might spring someone to the rim. But you don't want it to, even though Horford had a great game and has been a good shooter, you don't want like him with the ball on the perimeter.
Yeah. I think the options were to Tobias fronting, somebody, maybe Bazemore, by the rim, Horford on the pick and pop, and Josh kind of just ran away like as like a safety valve. And Ben did one look off to get Scal looking the other way, but yeah, it was. I think it might have just been Korkmaz. I think that might have been absolutely option A. Maybe B and C were Horford and Tobias, but wow.
Yeah. And then coming after the the fucking Simon's three in this like the same spot in the other corner, which
Front of the opposite team's bench, which is a tough time. I was before the Simon's shot, which I had assumed was going in because I knew Korkmaz was coming. To me it didn't take away my enjoyment because I just was cackle laughing at like whatever 6:30 in the morning it was. Just watching Korkmaz take it, I have no idea how to react. Because he just has never in America has anyone been that happy to see him or do anything. That moment was, you know, 40 points in summer league looks like nothing at this point. And I'd say that as an ardent supporter of summer league buckets. I was watching looking at the court, like the NBA is pretty loose with like opposing benches or just benches in general being on the court a little bit. And I was looking at it, I was like, man, that's gotta be a hard place to shoot from, especially if somebody's kind of like, you know, not abiding by the lines as much as they should. And Simons, I thought maybe stepped out at a point, but that was a hell of a shot. And then Korkmaz, same thing. Unbelievable. Korkmaz to stay in from the confetti shot, to stay in bounds, first of all, from the confetti point, which is, I think, officially what that place is called. It's not the corner anymore. That corner specifically is the confetti spot. And to keep his puppies behind the line is unbelievable.
Well, somebody, I think people tweeted that to us and emailed, like, how does Korkmaz keep those giant yellow bird feet like in bounds over there? It just, I demand to see a replay of his feet. And that, just thinking about watching it live, obviously I would have been glad the Sixers won, but really Simons hitting the three pointer to beat them, I can't guarantee how I would have felt when he hit that shot if I saw it live. With my Anfernee Simons backing over the last couple of years would have been a good moment too. So it was a great shot. His reaction was great. Al Horford seems to fucking love Korkmaz more than anybody else on the team, which is so perfect.
It was just cool seeing. I mean, I think Kylo Quinn hugged Korkmaz 8 times in under like a minute and a half. And I imagine a Kylo Quinn hug is really impactful and affects you in a deep way. You're not the same person you were before he hugged you. It's really fun. There are a bunch of people on Twitter that predicted that I would call Korkmaz a sweet boy, and he is. He really is a very sweet boy, and it's cool to see him like be happy. And it's a long fucking season. There's going to be ups and downs. He's going to get in the doghouse, whatever. But these kinds of moments where it's like, hey, that was great. What a fun. Everybody gets their part. Like, it's cool to see, you know, Mike Scott post about Korkmaz and Embiid and Simmons and being fun, where it's like, if it was one of the main guys, then it becomes like, you know, that's what they do. That's what they're supposed to do kind of thing. But when it's a random guy like this or even, you know, when Mike Scott had a hit the cash out moment, those kinds of things is when it's really fun to see. It feels much more like a college team in that sense of, wow, this guy got to be the hero for a night. And there's, you know, 75 other whatever games. But for this one, it was, you know, big, big pop of cork.
You didn't mention Josh Richardson calling him Furky Jerky, Jerky Furky from Turkey or something on Twitter. Solid. I think he called him.
Solid. Great. Everybody's excited. He's one of the gang. Yeah. I like when everybody's nice to each other. Come on.
All right. So let's, and the other interesting thing from Korkmaz, not just hitting the big shot, the Brett starting him in the second half.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it is impossible, and you know, I am not one for, you're the one for Korkmaz hyperbole, not me.
Although we both did miraculously like him before the draft.
Yes, that's one of the few things that is on the internet. Only until his next game.
That's right.
You can find that, but the
Korkmaz takes are also in the Disney vault.
I don't think it would be impossible, and we'll see, they play Phoenix on Monday night. I don't think it would be impossible given their lack of consistent shooting or their lack of gunner type shooting, which is, what did Brett say he wanted
bomber.
To create a bomber, their lack of bombers, that he may start over Thybulle.
By the way, Ithaca, which is where I went to college, mascot is a bomber. So that speaks to me particularly. I agree with you about Korkmaz starting. I think that's certainly a possibility. And maybe, I mean, obviously, when Embiid gets back, he'll be on the bench. But I think Matisse's impact off the bench right now feels better. This was his worst game. He still obviously had a couple nice moments and hit a big three late. But this was Matisse's worst game. And I think there's something about him coming off the bench and opposing teams having to be like, okay, fuck, this guy, whatever. Versus when he starts, it's like, all right, focus on this dude. Here's how to avoid him kind of thing. There's something... It feels more fresh as like as heat off the bench rather than no one's looking at Korkmaz and being like, uh-oh, this dude. And so, I mean, he's hitting shots right now. Him and Mike Scott were the only guys that hit multiple threes last night. A bunch of Sixers hit threes, but it's, you know, the shooting is going to be a question for a while, so may as well split those guys up and let Korkmaz run with the starters a little bit and see if he can keep doing this.
Might as well split up our three-point threats, Mike Scott and Furkan Korkmaz.
Hey,
so they.
It is what it is.
Does anyone miss a layup by throwing the ball right at the bottom of the rim like Thibault? I feel like I've seen him do that like 10 times this year. He had that weird switching
to his left hand, and it was like, just go up strong, man. Just go up strong with that right. You're very fast. It is what it is. Look, the offense was always going to be a work in progress. I believe in it. Like, I 100% believe in him becoming a good three-point shooter. I think he's kind of in the moment of, like, he plays at one speed right now on offense, and it's, like, very fast. And I think if he sort of took his time on those threes, especially now that they're giving him space and kind of daring him to beat him off from the shot, I would love him to slow down a little bit, but that's, you know, rookie style mistakes are going to happen. And he played 16 minutes and still had two steals and a block. Like he's just going to continue to create events on the defensive end, and the offense will come.
I think his rushing probably also has to do with the speed of the NBA, his adjustment to that. Like everything, the closing speed is so much faster. And I just imagine when you're on a break, because I think that one layup, I think it looked like he was by himself. You must just always hear footsteps.
Yeah.
You know, like you must see so many guys take it easy. And so I think that happens to him. We take a break from the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast to solve a problem for you. To solve a problem. Problem being that when you go to buy tickets to something, whether it be a sporting event or a concert, did you make that ding? Did you hear that?
Yeah. That was my water cup. We can start over.
Oh. No, keep it in there. That's okay. I thought you were like counting every time I did something. I thought you had a sound effect. Anyway, anytime you go to buy tickets to a sporting event or a concert or whatever, it's so difficult. You never know how much it's going to cost in the end. You never know if you're buying it from a secondary market or the original website. You have to go to four different websites. And you know why? It's because they don't really care about you. They almost make it more difficult on purpose. And that's why SeatGeek is so wonderful, because they solve that problem for you. They want to solve the problem of you having to go to a bunch of different websites and not knowing what a good price is by taking all of the websites that sell tickets and just put them in this one place. So all you have to do is go to SeatGeek. Here's how it works, Mike. Well, you already know how it works, but
I know it and love it and use it all the time.
Yes, it's good to use. That's why they have over 50,000 five-star reviews in the Apple App Store. Here's what happens. They take all of the tickets and they put them into this one site, and then they rate the deal that you're getting on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being a great deal, 1 being a not great deal. And they even give you a color-coded, if you don't like numbers, if you hate numbers, if you don't understand them, I don't know, us sometimes. If you don't have any idea, green is a great deal, yellow, okay deal, red is a bad deal. Let's say you're looking for tickets to the next home game, which is November 10th against Charlotte. Right now, cheapest tickets in the house, you can get section 209, row 12 for only $24.
That's great.
You get in the building for $24. And look, if you want an even better ticket, section 113, which is right in the middle, lower level, you can get for $219, which is like an okay deal. But that's how easy it is on SeatGeek. And it's not just sporting events. It is concerts. It is plays, musicals, whatever. I've used SeatGeek a number of times. I mentioned last week I used a SeatGeek to get Julia Michaels tickets at actually cheaper than they actually were originally, which is great. Use SeatGeek. That's what you got to do. You can get $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase by using our promo code RTRS. That's right. SeatGeek cares about you so much. Not only do they have a great app, download it. They're going to give you $10 off for using the promo code RTRS just for listening to this podcast. Once again, promo code RTRS for $10 off your first purchase. SeatGeek.
SeatGeek.
Back to the pod. The other, I think, really big thing in the game in the second half was Neto. Neto played well the other night, and then Neto was great. It seems like the one thing that he doesn't really do is, like, he is definitely he's not the break a guy down, that's the Burke thing, but he's a little more athletic than I figured he would be. He's a good defender.
Yeah.
And he just a little bit of energy on defense, you know, he's pesky and he's good at it. Neto sort of turned the game. It was him. It was him coming in for Simmons at that moment and playing. I don't even think it was anything more than what, 8 or 10 minutes, something
six.
Like that. But yeah, it was the most important 6 minutes that anybody played in the game.
I agree. I think there's something to be said, and there's always got to be sort of a process simile. It's like when I think it was Larry Drew was the first one to, like, the first Sixers point guard where it's like, oh, they just, like, can dribble and make a pass and occasionally hit a three. And obviously Simmons is his own very unique, very good basketball player. And obviously Josh Richardson is working on becoming a secondary initiator and can do a bunch of things that I really love. Neither of them are, like, the pure definition of a point guard. Raul Neto is, like, is that guy. Like, he's exactly tailor-made, built in a lab, backup point guard. I think TJ could have been that if the shot was good. Neto's a much better shooter than TJ, and I think probably a better, or at least more consistent defender than TJ is. Although I did watch TJ have a TJ play today where he tipped an inbounds pass and stole it on the opposition, and he never expected. I think it was Chris Dunn. It was like, come on, man. You got to know that he's going to do that. Anyway.
Yeah. And by the way, Chris Dunn, same sort of guy, you know? If anybody should expect it, it's Dunn.
I love Neto, and I have no... Kyle Newbeck's been banging this drum a lot, but I've been Brett open up those rotations for... before Brett even got here. Simmons and Tobias and Josh played 35, 36 minutes each, which is fine. It's not too much, but, like, I have no problem with them at this stage in the game, at this point in the season, 32, 33, give, like, 6 to 8 minutes to Neto, 10, 15 minutes, whatever, if he's going well, get Burke in there, rotate guys in, keep them fresh. You never know when you're going to need guys, and I just don't want to burn dudes early, and they're, you know, it's a long fucking season. This is, as much as I want the number one seed, and I want it, I want that home court advantage. It's much, you want guys fresh, and I trust these guys to regulate themselves, but Brett can do a better job of making sure that, you know, I'm glad he put Neto in then, but Neto should just be a part of the rotation, and it should just be like, we go 10 deep at this point. This is when
there's no reason why he shouldn't. You can play him with Simmons. The big problem with TJ is that you couldn't play him with Simmons, right? Like, you can play Neto with Simmons. What are we doing? Yeah. Why are we forcing Josh Richardson? And by the way, even when Neto was in, a lot of the time, Neto was not bringing the ball up the court. Yeah. It was Richardson.
This idea,
the ball.
Like, the arbitrary idea of, like, the point guard is the person who brings the ball up the court. Like, Kylo Quinn sometimes brings the ball up the court. Like, Horford does. It's not as, you want someone there who can, like, just sort of control the game. And it's not bad to have multiple guys on there that can. I'm pro Josh Richardson, like, let him work out the kinks of his backup point guard experiment, because I do think ultimately in a playoff series, depending on matchup, maybe early first round, you can have Neto in there for a little bit. But I think, or Shake if he's healthy and playing well at that point. But I think as it gets deeper into the playoffs, you're going to shorten that rotation to, like, 8 guys. You want guys in there that can really play both ways and switch and do everything. So you want it to be Josh. Ideally, it's Josh. So I'm fine working out the kinks as the season goes along, but that also means, like, let's make sure everybody's fresh and give Neto some time in there. Like, I'd love for, you know, Embiid misses the Phoenix game, but the game after that, which is like Denver or whatever, like, sit Josh. Give Josh one day off to watch and think and, like, let's play Neto a lot. Like, that should be a rotation thing. That should always happen.
Well, they signed him. He's on the team.
What do you mean?
Just fucking play him. Neto. I just, like, whatever. I don't want to make a huge deal out of it.
Short rotation, I think, always has. Yeah. But now that the team is good and there are multiple decent guys on the bench, I'm not talking about Jonah Bolden, but I think Neto or Burke at all times should be in the rotation. Just, like, get him in there, mix it up, give Ben some breaks, all that stuff. That's the whole
point.
Is
that's whole,
that's
pretty
all
amazing.
I'm bringing to this podcast is begging for better, deeper rotations.
It is amazing to see, like, the different sides of Al Horford, to go from, like, the biggest play he made in the, what was the game they won on the big, what was the big Embiid game? It was Atlanta. And basically all Horford did was throw that pass at the end. And it was, he was doing his Horford thing the rest of the game, but there wasn't much Horford. This one, he's shooting 25 times. He's dunking. He was all over the place.
A career high in field goal attempts. Did you see that?
Oh, no. It was like 24, 25,
24
right?
That's field how many goal times attempts. I believe someone said it was a career high. He took no foul shots, so I'm sure that impacted it. But Al Horford still got it. He looks not, we'll see what he looks like in a couple of years, but right now, his game is going to age as gracefully as a baby hook in the lane where he's got his guy to bite on the first pump fake. It's going to be really nice. I love it.
It seemed like, I don't know how many it was because I watched, you watched it this morning. I actually watched the game on the plane.
So it's very fresh for you.
Yeah, very fresh for me.
Had you not seen the Korkmaz play at all?
I saw the Korkmaz play on Twitter, and people were like, "Why aren't you tweeting about it?" And I was like, "I didn't watch the game. I don't need to jump into the middle of every social media event. There are plenty of people that are going to get likes out of it. It will be fine." I saw it last night, and then I saw it again. I saw it this morning, and then I watched
delightful.
The game.
Also, that Al Horford pump and go Statue of Liberty dunk.
Like, yeah,
oh,
it was
really
great.
Nice. Well, one of those in every fourth quarter where the game is up for grabs the rest of the season, please.
It seemed like there were 10 awesome Kylo Quinn passes. I don't know if there were, but that's how it felt.
Five assists for Kylo Quinn. Sixers, 36 assists on 54 buckets. That's really good. They're a good passing team. Mainly it's Simmons, and maybe it's ball movement. I thought there were nice swing passes from everybody. I thought it was a really nice Tobias game. But Kyle Newbeck also made the point that having Neto in there as just like another good passer with O'Quinn, with Simmons, like just mixing guys in there, because Horford's a good passer. But like Matisse, Ennis, Korkmaz are all like Tobias are like serviceable passers. Josh Richardson's not an excellent passer. Like it's nice to have guys that are like looking for that shit. And more of those guys is not a bad thing.
Good Ennis game, I thought. Pretty good Ennis game.
Oh, the best. He's great. Yeah. He's just a delight. Really uses his fouls. Same can be said for Kylo Quinn. There's just a bunch of good of it's the perfect level of to some extent, like, look, have I been fetishizing a lineup of entire 6'10" beefy dudes who can't shoot for my whole life? No. But in some ways, this is the ideal team for me, of like a couple very unique players surrounded by guys who know their role and play defense. That is my kind of team. And hopefully Simmons and Embiid can keep developing their game to where they can be, you know, two of the best 10 best players in the league on every night, especially once it gets into playoffs. But this is my kind of team, man. I like these guys. And they really seem to give a shit about each other, and it's very fun.
Someone emailed me, and I don't know if this is true, but someone emailed me a stat from Twitter that the Sixers, this was before the Portland game, Sixers are the only team in the NBA who do not have an unassisted three-point shot.
Wow.
It does seem like possible that that would be the case. They don't really have anybody who would do that. And you know, I wanted to back that up. I didn't mean to seg into this, but the Tobias Harris, I was talking about him shooting, you know, 8 threes in the last game and how he needs to shoot more of them. It is fair to mention, and I didn't do this, and I thought about it while I was watching him on a couple of his offensive possessions, is that it's not like Tobias Harris has always been like a gunner or something. And his 3-point shot, I don't think came until his like third season.
Maybe, and I think a little after that.
Yeah. So it's not really who he is. And he looks, when he shoots them quickly, they end up short a lot. It just doesn't seem like that is how he thinks about it. He's more comfortable, you know, getting the ball and working it. And if he's open, he'll shoot it.
Yeah.
But he does, that's not really who he is. Now, I do think he needs to adjust and maybe sacrifice a couple of points on the 3-point percentage, but he's not super comfortable. I almost wish that in his off season of working on his defensive lateral quickness, which he was never going to improve, I actually wish he worked on, and I don't know if he didn't, but like, getting up a billion threes probably would have been more helpful.
I think he's a guy who works really hard. He is a there's some Carmelo to his game in that, like, occasionally when it's his time, the ball stops and he like kind of looks around. He wants to like get the measure of the guy defending him. It's not a ton of quick decisions. Now I think he cuts really well. I think when he attacks a closeout, he goes in a straight line right to the basket, and there's not much dancing around that. But there is occasionally a very play at his own pace type, all right, now it's his turn to like look his guy up and down, and maybe there's a couple threes that you'd wish that he could just get off quickly, but he's assessing what's in front of him more. Defensively, I thought this was an excellent Tobias defensive game. Like, Portland made a shit ton of shots, but there were a bunch of really nice plays. He had two blocks and a steal. I think those all were kind of, they weren't like blocks to me, they were steal type blocks, you know, when someone's going up for like a layup or something around there, rather than like the shot is off and he's like rising up like Mitchell Robinson and blocking it. I think his hands have been much more active. There was a play, towards the end of the game when it was, they ended up turning the ball over. He was on Dame on an island and really held his own and was moving with him and was like ready for the step back, but not selling out for it. I'm seeing the improvement, and I think that's just all we can hope for.
And I guess the last the one sequence I loved was I just want to say Anfernee Simons is good, and when he blocked Korkmaz and then came back and then hit the three, I like him. I like Anfernee Simons a lot.
Yeah, it's cool. He's cool.
He's good, man. He is.
He's certainly a good offensive player and can be a very good offensive player at some point. You know,
he's so young. He's so like young. Face looks young. His body's young.
I don't know if I was happy for him knowing that Korkmaz was about to hit the shot with 2.2 seconds left. I wonder if I would have been happy if I didn't know it was going to happen. It was just like, fuck this guy, whatever, piece of shit. But like knowing it was like, oh, what a nice moral victory for you before we rip your heart out. Yeah. And you know who else fucking kills us is Rodney Hood. He must be,
he must shoot
85% against the Sixers lifetime. Just no one on the Sixers has ever been able to cover Rodney Hood. Now, a lot of those points were against Korkmaz, who, by the way, I also think this was one of his better defensive games. There was a moment when he was covering Dame seemingly by design. That seems like a bad idea. But Korkmaz had a bunch of nice plays and moved his feet defensively, had a couple blocks, a couple strips, getting his big, you know, we talk about his big feet. You know what comes with big feet? Big hands. And so get those hands in there, poke some things out with those fingernails, and let's go. I was impressed by, even though Portland scored 128 points and their offensive rating was very high, they shot fucking 56% from three.
Yeah.
Like, that's not going to happen all the time. Some were wide open and some were like defensive breakdowns. But I thought, aside from those Rodney Hood just carving up Korkmaz moments, there were a bunch of nice things to like, okay, I see these guys getting better on defense, and I see a team ethos kind of building of people taking defense personally. And I think that starts with Brett. And I think these guys are putting the work in.
And that was the last thing, just a I don't know. It was a good Brett game. I thought overall, like, look, the game, it looks like a good coach game when the decisions you make work, you know, mm-hmm. like when Neto has the 6 minutes he did and when Korkmaz hits the shot. But if you're going to get blamed for shit that isn't your fault, you should get credit for shit that, you know, like, you know, he's, I'm glad that he has better players and that he is, you know, the fact that Brett Brown is the coach of a 6-0 basketball team.
5-0.
6-0, 5-0, 5-0 basketball team.
He hasn't coached any of the wins, though.
No, right. Well, it'll be great to see him finally coach a game this year.
Yeah,
we'll
see when that happens. Simmons, we really didn't talk about. It didn't seem to me like a very good Simmons game.
It wasn't.
Watching it, and then obviously those two.
He did hit those free throws.
Those free throws were absolutely big. Huge. Andre Iguodala-esque. He was coming into this shooting like 44% from the line. And to hit those two after a timeout to take the lead, that's really big. I know it's just a game in early November, but on the road against a good team without Embiid, like him hitting those free throws to me is a really encouraging sign. But then you look at his stats and 18, 11, 8, 2 steals and 3 turnovers, like shooting 7 of 16 from the field. Like that's 4 or 5 from the line. That's totally fine. We're getting, you know, obviously we see the oh, he didn't even play well and he had like 28 and 12 is more of an Embiid thing. But I think there's some of that to Simmons also where he can impact the game in so many ways, even when he's not playing that well. I thought there were a couple defensive choices that he made that I didn't necessarily agree with. But when they were down big, he was a big part of like starting things on the defensive end and getting quick offense, quick buckets on the other end to start to cut into that lead quicker.
Yeah, it was not a great Simmons game, but even his worst game, like unless it's one of those, you know, those playoff games where he is, you know, the few ones against Toronto or Boston where he's been minimized and it's been obvious, even his subpar games are still pretty good. I agree with everything that you said about him. But yeah, this was not one of his best ones.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Max Rappaport was at the game and said he hit 8 of 11 corner threes. I went back and I read a bunch of tweets before, like as the game happened, so I can relive it. So, you know, right after I had just seen the game. And so he thought that was going to be the game that he took a three again, but man, it just doesn't seem like he has any interest in that. It just doesn't seem like
I don't think Max knows he does that before every fucking game.
I know. I mean, you would think that there's game. I think it has to be a conscious decision you wonder, in practice, is like, are there possessions in practice when Ben is in the corner, like stretching the floor and at least spacing it? Because he's never there. Like he's never actually in the corner at a place where the ball could swing to him and he could hit an open three if nobody came out on it. There has not been that case. There's been a couple times, especially against Portland, handful of times in other games, when he's dribbling down and the screen is like at the elbow. And mm-hmm. his defender is way down there already, so he could just step into it cleanly. But he's usually running, so he has no interest in that. But I would love to see him just like space the floor a little bit more, so that he could even have the chance to turn down a ball swinging to him, and he hits a three. You know?
Yeah, it would. I don't know. Just not having him stand in the lane would be better. You know, or around the lane. I agree with you. He is consciously not in a spot, whether it's when he has the ball or it's whether he doesn't have the ball. He's never in the spot to take it.
Well, so I don't think it's a hard and fast rule. I don't think he should always be in the corner when he's not
no,
the one operating.
No, but it would be nice. It would be nice if it was occasionally.
Occasionally, I agree. I think, you know, 5 to 10 times a game, him being in the corner so that Tobias can do whatever, or Josh can do whatever. And the ball could swing to him if it's a drive and kick situation. I think sometimes he gets offensive rebounds in that way. He gets like, you know, you think about him and Matisse doing a little pick and roll in the corner where Matisse hit him with a pocket pass a couple times and he's just sort of like kind of casually rolling. I think Ben has done a much better job of screening and rolling so far this year. As a rookie, he just wasn't doing much of that, especially in that Boston series. And so there are a bunch of moments like that that I've been encouraged by, but it'd be nice to mix it up where it's like, okay, this is the play we run where Tobias and Horford are running a pick and roll at the top and Ben is in the corner. Like, I would just love to see that happen, and it seems like that's not really implemented into the playbook at all.
Just a normal NBA thing to do.
Look, they're always going to be a weird team. They're a very weird 5-0. Would love a, you know, this is what we signed up for. If we want to be, if we want a normal team, let's go root for the fucking, you know, I don't know, Pacers?
They're normalish. Boy, Brogdon's playing well.
Yeah, he's good.
We take a break from the podcast to talk about our sponsor, our guy. Love him to death. Love him. Just he's up there with family and my wife and my dog. That is L.L. Pavorsky, L.L. Pavorsky Jewelers.
Can I tell you something? I've had a number of friends get engaged recently, and my mom, first question every time, did they go to LL? Every time, they don't have to know LL. They don't have to have any relationship. They don't have to be in Philadelphia. She takes it so personally when people don't go to LL Pavorsky Jewelers. So don't anger my mother. Go see the guy.
As you should. In a momentous occasion this week, as LL celebrated the 150th Writes to Ricky Sanchez listener to get an engagement ring from LL. 150. It does seem like from 100 to 150 took a really short amount of time.
Did it?
Well, I remember 100. It was like less than a year ago. It just seems like so many people are getting engaged. It's just,
and honestly,
it's unreal.
Theoretically, someone is getting engaged to someone else. So that 150 is closer to 300 in my mind.
Right. If you're doing the math for real, if we're talking about real math here, I wonder if we're going to... It seems like every fly of the process, we have somebody getting engaged. Maybe that'll happen in Indianapolis. Who wouldn't want to get engaged in Indianapolis at a bar with TJ McConnell? I'm telling you, LL's going. I think young Missy is going to Indianapolis as well. 150 people, and who knows how many others didn't get engagement rings. Maybe they already had engagement rings, got other jewelry from LL. It is a low-pressure experience with a good guy going to get you the right jewelry at the right price, and you will offend Mike's mother if you don't go to LL. 707 Walnut is where the store is, 215-627-2252. If you want to set up an appointment to go in there to buy an engagement ring, like, he's open normal hours, but if you talk to him first, he'll have everything ready for you. Or you just tweet at him at LL Pavorsky, email him llpavorsky.com. Donations decoded by kids in Providence Animal Center with every pod. LL Pavorsky Jewelers.
My mom loves being a part of the pod.
Back to the pod. All right, I want to transition.
About Sixers. They get carved up by these kinds of guards who can score. And when Embiid's in there, it's obviously not as bad. But the thing that the Blazers do that's really interesting is usually when it's like Harden, or I guess Harden doesn't even really get that many pick and rolls these days. It's mostly just him isolated. But like those kinds of guys, Kemba or whatever, the pick will come at or slightly above the three-point line. And with Dame and CJ, mainly Dame, Scalabissiere is screening at like 30 to 35 feet away. And so you can go behind that. Dame hits those at a pretty decent clip. But when
he did last night,
he did.
Yeah.
But when Matisse gets, or whoever, Josh gets like actually eaten up by that screen, and Kylo Quinn or Horford or Embiid is dropping way back, that's a really, they can slow down into that stop, into that three, and Dame hits that easily. And so and towards the end of the game, I think Brett adjusted, and there was one time when Kyle O'Quinn didn't step up, and I'm like, Josh and Ben were kind of like yelling at him to like, hey man, you got to step up. That's what we're doing now. But I wonder what the situation would be if could you just do like a pure switch and just say like, all right, Horford, now you're, If Scal wants to screen that high up, then now Horford just has Dame. Because it seems really not a thing that can last. Against shooters that can hit shots off the dribble, if they're going to screen that high and you're going to go over it, then that's him walking into a three is not an effective way. It's not a sustainable way to cover that team. And I think Brett adjusted in some ways and maybe it helped a little, but man, those were some wide open fucking looks. And they're not hitting shots at the rim. They weren't. But certainly not a, at least last night, not a good way to do it. I wonder how that changes in the playoffs.
No, and you can't. We're excellent at saying the other team's just hitting a number of shots that they don't normally hit.
56% is a high number of threes.
Yeah, but the way things even out is that they also didn't hit shots at the rim, which doesn't seem to make a ton of sense either. So things even out, you know. But I agree with you on the defensive scheme of all of it. It just doesn't seem like we should have the personnel anymore where that should be a problem. Like, it was a problem after Covington got traded. I'm sorry for mentioning him. I don't want anyone to have a pee pants problem because I said Robert Covington. But like, since then, since having him to just having somebody to just throw on them, it seems like it's been a problem. And with this personnel, we shouldn't have that problem anymore.
But it's really, I mean, I think Josh and Matisse can cover those guys. I think.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
When screening comes, what is the big doing? And I think that is the thing that the Sixers need to figure out. Mainly, they're dropping when it's a 19 footer, and Matisse is like kind of behind them, about to block them from behind, or at least putting some heat on them so they feel it. That's one thing. But when it's Matisse is getting swallowed up by a screen 5 feet away, and he can just walk into a three, that's a really good shot for Dame. That's not a difficult shot for him to take at all. And I wonder what the optimal thing to do there is and what it will be in the playoffs if it ends up being just a pure switch in the playoffs. I don't know.
And there are more and more players that can hit that shot confidently.
Kemba can do that. Kyle Lowry can do that. Mm-hmm. Bledsoe, if he's not shitting the bed in the playoffs, can do that. Like, there's a bunch of those kinds of players, and I wonder what that situation will be like. Certainly something they have to work on as the year goes on.
So our last pod was right after the Embiid fight, and he ended up getting 2 games, which we have a perfect mailbag question to kick off the mailbag about that. And we got a couple of really good emails this week, and this one I really enjoyed. This comes from Eric. Hey, Spike and Mike, I'm a devoted fan of the Ricky and the process, despite being a 77-year-old retired foundation executive living in rural Connecticut. Maybe I've reached the get off my lawn stage of my life, but I don't understand your reaction to the Embiid Towns fight. I usually love your fun-loving refusal to take anything, including yourselves, too seriously, but I have to disagree that the entertainment value of the Embiid Towns scuffle excuses its darker side. Isn't there a line between bully ball, post-ups and tight defense, and outright bullying, physical intimidation? Isn't there a line between good-humored trash-talking and trying to humiliate and emasculate your opponent? Did Embiid cross those lines? Shouldn't we at least ask that question instead of just laughing off his suspension as another form of load management? At a time when our national life is so polarized and so angry, shouldn't we try to keep sports as a sheltered place where we can come together and compete hard, but with an unwavering respect for the rules and our opponents?
Well, so
I love Embiid. Hold on, let me finish. I love Embiid, but I worry that he is in danger of putting himself above the game. Remind you of anyone. I don't really expect you to take this too seriously, but I had to get it off my chest. Thanks for the pod. It's great. Eric W., not Eric Jr.
Love it. I think it's a very physical game. Like, and especially when your play is physical, the Sixers do. Like, there's going to be scuffles as the season goes on. I had no problem with Embiid. Embiid, the play that like started it was Embiid like rushing a double team and turning Towns over, which was great. And then started a fast break and we got a bucket at the other end. When they got their arms tangled and they did the like, I'm not tangling you, you're tangling me, your arms caught on mine, not the other way around. And then they just started shoving and then that escalates. Like, that happens. Like, it happens to me sometimes at my like, you know, middling basketball games. It happens all the time. It's a physical game. Guys are around each other. Guys are frustrated. Like, emotions come out. I had no problem with the game, with that part of the fight. Bringing it onto social media to then, like, I think he made the point of emasculate. Like, yeah, I thought that was it. I mean, as much as I do like Mike Scott a lot, the idea of, like, ain't no bitch is very gendered and not in a way that, like, get super pumped about. And I think the quote sort of supersedes that and it's like moved beyond that, but it's still like at least based in that sense. And the idea that like, if you don't fight someone and then try to like ruin their life on Twitter afterwards, then you're a girl, which is just like, it bums me out. I think that it maybe went a step too far. I think there's trash talking is cool. I think guys actually disliking each other is cool.
I love when guys are very physical on the court and they like get into it, and then after the game they're like, no, that's my guy, I love him. It's just, you know, got heated, and that, because that's what happens. I think it happened in a what was the game? It was like Pat Beverly and somebody the other night. People were acting as if it was a big fight, and both guys were like, no, this is my guy. Like, I love this guy. We just got physical. It is what it is. And that happens. But I also like the idea that there's sometimes you just don't like people, and you get to be physical on the court with them. It's a physical game, and occasionally that spills over. I think as fun as sometimes the, like, internet trash talk gets, I think the point of emasculating them is a valid one. And I think if you can do it in a more, like, I don't like that guy, fuck that dude, way less, like, you've always been a pussy bitch, that are very, like, you know, female-centric terms, then I think it'd be better. But, you know, I do think on the whole it was an enjoyable experience. Nobody got hurt. 2-game suspension, everybody's okay. But I hear the point. If it happens a lot more, I think then it's something that, you know, everybody should take a little less enjoyment at. But if it's one time, once in a while, I think it's fun. You're allowed to, I think you're allowed to enjoy it.
Yeah, I mostly agree. He has to realize that our reaction was a little bit sort of like slap happy at that point. Like, it was, I was seeing the quotes mostly for the first time as I woke up at 3 a.m. and it was funny. The more I thought about it, the problem is like, you want to say, hey, I have no problem with him being tough. I even have no problem with the fight happening, but I wish he wouldn't do that stuff afterwards. The problem is like the same, energy that creates the fight stuff. It doesn't, when you get into something like that, it doesn't just wear off right away. Like, you, and the problem with social media is you see everybody talking about your fight. I think it keeps those juices flowing, but, like, of course. And I know that particular part is important to you. Even if he wasn't using female words for it, even if he was calling him like a piece of shit on the internet, which is neither male nor female, sure. I don't think he needs to do that afterwards either. I love Mike Scott. I love him, and I love how honest he is, and I really do. But I don't think afterwards that you want to be saying how fun it was to watch the fight all the time.
I get it. It is fun. Yeah. Like, I get that sense of it.
They are going to, my ultimate fear is not that they're going to beat people up all the time, because I really don't think that's who they are at all. I think they will just be physical, to Eric's point, but you don't want the refs thinking that that's what you want. Yeah. And you don't want the league thinking that that's what you want, because then it's going to make it harder for you to do the thing that you want to do.
Yeah.
And the thing that they want to do is not that.
I think at this point that they do have a target on their back. And Embiid's always had one, because he brings it on himself. And I think now as a team, they kind of do. Like, Ben's obviously had his own scuffles with various people, Kyle Lowry, Marcus Morris, Mike Scott gets into it with guys. I'm sure Kylo Quinn will get into it with somebody at a certain point this year. Josh might as well, I think, although I think everybody respects his, like, elevated role playerness in a way that doesn't, like, take it as personally. Horford will not get into any fights and will stand there. But I do think that it gets to a point where if you have a target on your back, there could be, the next time this happens, the suspensions could get longer and the flagrant fouls could get called quicker. It's when referees have the Sixers game, it's going to be like, okay, now we know, like, we're on watch for it. And the shittiest thing would be if, you know, a bunch of flagrant fouls add up and they get suspended for a game in the playoffs.
Yeah.
Like, that would, that would suck. Like, that would genuinely suck. And I think that's part of it, is that the league is reactionary to that stuff. I was watching a bunch of games today. I forget what game it was. Oh, it was a Houston game where they got called for a flagrant foul that was like not even anything. And it's just like, what is the point? I'm going to rant about this every time, but, like, what is the point? You can't retroactively be like, no, you shouldn't have fouled him. Like, going forward, it's just going to be, you're either going to let up easy buckets, which will piss off your fan base of get off my lawn older people, and everybody that likes defense or just wants their team to win, or, like, you're going to call a flagrant and let them get two shots and the ball for a time when it's just like, hey, I'm just trying to stop a bucket. Like, it's bad, and the league needs to correct it and actually think of what the purpose of a flagrant foul is to say, like, hey, if you overly aggressively, in with like some intent to harm, do a play that causes somebody to get hurt or almost get hurt, whatever it is, then we're going to penalize you. But if sometimes there's hard fouls, and I just, it kills me. And I think the Sixers are because of who they are and who they've been, but especially now after that, both the Mike Scott thing in Atlanta and the Embiid Towns thing, is they do have some target on their back. And I don't think this is the last time we will have these kinds of flagrant suspension frustrations going forward. Hopefully not in the playoffs, but something to keep an eye on.
I sort of disagree with the flagrant thing. I think it's pretty easy what they're trying to enforce. I just don't know if it's possible. They're trying to say you have to be doing a basketball thing, not just hitting the guy's arm on purpose so he doesn't score. Like that,
But the worst thing, sure, something you've seen, like the first guy that comes to mind is like Stauskas. When somebody goes up for an easy dunk and Stauskas is like, okay, foul him. And he like slaps him on the arm and then it's an easy and one. And it's like, well, that's not what you want. So you want a slightly harder foul. And if a guy is coming in so hard for a big dunk that you have to, I mean, maybe the answer is just let him go. But I know that that will bum a lot of people out, players and fans alike.
Next email from Daniel. Is it too early to power rank teams in the East that we should be afraid of? I can only imagine four we should consider: Celtics, Heat, Bucks, and Raptors. I could see an argument for Detroit if Blake comes back, but I just can't work up the energy to worry about Detroit. To be honest, Miami would be number one for me. The team is tough, and it would be ugly to see them do better with us, do better than us with Jimmy Butler. P.S. It is so weird that Spike is such a polarizing figure. People love calling him a dick, but have these people never encountered someone as abrasive or as odd as Spike? I'm in Maine, and it's beautiful here, but the landscape is fraught with tough hangs. Spike is fine.
Wow.
I don't think I'm polarizing. I think the problem is Twitter. I've been to a million of our events, and I don't see anybody that hates me there. So I think it's just Twitter. All right, teams that we should be afraid of, with also saying that we're not actually afraid
of
anyone.
I think it's, it's early for that. I still feel good about our position in the East. I think Boston is going to be tough as the season goes on. I do think they're going to get a more playable center that can hang. Toronto's still good. We'll see how much they hold up over a long season. Gasol doesn't look... He looks kind of washed in a way that kind of bums me out, because I do think he's still a really good player, but he seems like he can't compete anymore or move as well. Miami looks good. They look really good, and I sort of didn't buy it for a little bit, and it's still only five or six games, whatever. Jimmy is playing a lot harder than he played in the regular season here, and maybe it was...
That's all right. It won't last.
Maybe not, but there's a bunch of... Yeah. Good guys, good dudes on that team that can fucking play. And they have shooters.
Well, Hero's good. I'll tell you that. That guy's good.
Duncan Robinson was hitting a ton of shots. He's a Michigan guy who I really did not think could hang in the NBA, but he's big enough and he's hitting shots. Bam Adebayo
was
really
fucking
good.
Who's that fucking guy that was like in the G League and is now scoring 20 points a game?
Yeah, Kendrick Nunn. Yeah.
Yeah.
They just have guys, and I think Spoelstra is a really good coach, and forever, whatever like psycho fucking culture they have there of get in shape or we're going to cut you, it seems to at least work for some guys. And they're not, I would really love to not face them in the playoffs, just because it's going to be half the team would get suspended. Like, that would be a very,
let's go, man. Let's go with that.
Yeah.
Well,
it'd be fun to face Jimmy. There's a bunch of good players on that team. Like Embiid would cook Myers Leonard. I love Bam. I really think he's a fun guy to watch and root for. But there's a couple, you know, I don't want like, you know, Tobias Harris getting his jaw broken by James Johnson. Like, that doesn't seem, that's not basketball.
Well, you know, why do they get in shape in Miami? Because that's where all the fucking PEDs are. That's where LeBron used to go on vacation. All of a sudden, he would come back after missing 2 weeks, and everything would be fine. They have all the HGHs in fucking Miami.
Loose,
that's
frivolous HGH accusations getting thrown around by notorious non-dick Spike Eskin.
Let me tell you something. I would say that 50% of the NBA over 28 years old is on some kind of PED. How come there's like, what are they? There's like one PED suspension every 2 years in the NBA.
Wilson Chandler.
Who are we kidding ourselves? Right.
DeAndre Ayton.
And what's that?
DeAndre Ayton.
Did Ayton have a PED? Yeah.
Diuretic, yeah, right. Which isn't that something that they use to like conceal? Isn't that the idea?
Yep.
I don't know.
Yeah.
This podcast, I have not used a single PED for this podcast. Not one.
No, I haven't. And then finally, this one comes from Kelsey. We'll end on a high note. Look, I love the Sixers team. I love Joel Embiid. He's everything I thought I wanted in a player. And I know the Ben-Joel relationship talk feels tired, but I can't shake the feeling we're all just in denial. After the fight, Ben went out of his way to say that he had Joel's back, and Joel gave him zero love in return. Instead, he shouted out Jimmy Butler, which he's done repeatedly, and I can't help feeling at the expense of Ben. Ben seems to go out of his way to build bridges this season, talking about the team's success in every interview, while Joel just seems more and more self-absorbed. It seems like Horford, Harris, Richardson are all very supportive of Ben, talking about his leadership, while their rare comments on Joel are simply to say that he's good. I tried to find a single Joel quote that felt supportive or even just nice about Ben to assuage this feeling and came up empty. I feel like Joel feels
this
like
is a high note? Star-
yeah, I was being sarcastic.
Waiting I feel like for a Joel- high note.
I feel like Joel feels like he's the star and everyone else should be bowing down. But in case he hasn't noticed, even LeBron, Harden, Kawhi are welcoming make room for second stars. I find myself liking Ben more and more and Joel less and less this season. Your thoughts?
Interesting. Interesting take. I do think there was a quote, and I don't have it on hand, but I do think after the fight there was a quote from Embiid being like, these are my guys, it's my team, like they have my back, I have theirs, it's Philly, like that kind of thing. Like that's the team ethos, whatever it is. So I think that is like a togetherness, if not a specifically like calling out Ben's situation. I agree that that seems like, it seems like Ben is maybe not going out of his way, but sort of making a point to try to build bridges and be there for him and stuff. I would love to see, you know, look, I'm not going to turn down Instagram post or story from Brett of, you know, Embiid buying Ben like a nice bottle of wine or something. Like that would be great. I would love to hear that. But maybe there's a certain amount of denial going into it, but
yeah,
there, you know, sometimes smoke is just the product of a lovely roast and people are having a nice meal. Maybe there's no fire at all. Maybe it's a very contained smoke and there's a glaze going on to onto the meat, and that's very nice. Maybe that's all it is.
I think here's the thing to make you feel better. Nobody was more happy when Ben hit the three than Embiid was.
True.
So there's that. But on the other end of it, how about Joel Embiid stops talking about Jimmy Butler after every fucking game?
I wonder, like, how does that make you feel as maybe the biggest Jimmy Butler hater in Philadelphia?
Well, Embiid loved Butler and loved Redick. And this offseason was not like the perfect Embiid offseason. Like it was basically, here's the two guys that you felt like made your life easier. And we're going to sign. And I know for a 30-year-old or a 32-year-old, this might be great. But we're also going to sign the guy that plays basically your same position and also whipped your ass the last 2 years. That's what's going to happen. So I think there is a similarity in personality, not the bad part of Jimmy Butler's personality, but Jimmy Butler loves to like tweak people. And I think so does Embiid. And I think Embiid liked that part of him too. But I don't know if it's to tweak Simmons, but like, it's not, you know, like there's no way Simmons like loves Butler or anything. So he's not on the team anymore. He fucking ran away. He left on, like, I know you loved him, Joel, but he fucking left. He left. He was a prick while he was here, and then he decided to leave. So fuck him. Like, we don't need, he's not Michael Jordan. He's like, last year was the furthest he's ever gotten gotten in the playoffs in his whole career. So like, let's not all bow down to like the god that is Jimmy Butler. He's, his whole mythos, like everything about him is made up and he made it up. So let's chill out. We don't need to talk about Jimmy Butler after every game.
I was frustrated to watch the Miami-Houston game tonight and see Jimmy just so confidently and carelessly rise up for threes. And I'm just like, you motherfucker, why didn't you do that here? You fucking
purposely
piece of
didn't
shit.
Do it.
What the hell?
Yeah. Fuck him.
But that's fine. Oh, I had another thought. There's nothing, but if we're wrapping up, just a final thing. I was in watching the game. There's just another moment where I was like, I'm so glad that, I know I said this in the live pod, I'm so glad that Mike Scott isn't Mike Muscala. It's such a nice thing. Like, there was he had a drive where he just had like a beat a guy off the dribble and like kind of went around somebody and hit like a little floater, little like teardrop type thing. And I was like, could you imagine Mike Muscala dribbling in traffic or trying to like get past someone? I'm just so happy that it's Mike Scott. And I, you know, he is what he is, the seventh or eighth guy on this team, whatever. But God, what great for character and for teamwork and for not being Mike Muscala.
The West Coast trip continues this week with Phoenix and Utah, right? And by the way, I don't know if you've seen him, but there's no way that Nikola Jokic isn't fatter than he was last year. Mm. What a just a big fat slob that guy is.
Things getting, have some self-respect. A little seeming off in Denver. Seeming slightly off there.
Yeah.
It's a weird season.
So far. They are.
It's every season, too. Early. It always feels so weird the first like couple weeks of the season. And it's always like, is this how it always is? Like, are we always in this kind of weird amorphous zone where there's teams that are like good and then bad and fake and whatever. And every year I go through the same, like, what is happening? Is this how basketball season always is? And it never get normalized. That's it.
Okay.
That's all I have.
Well, we're out. I'm going to bed. We'll talk to you next time on the podcast.
Watch Perfect Harmony. My episode premieres on Thursday night.
Oh, it's your episode?
It's my episode, the episode I co-wrote with my writing partner, Patrick Kang. It's very good. I say with unbiased eyes that it is the best of the season. Watch it. It's on Hulu. It's on NBC.com. Perfect Harmony. It's a funny comedy. There's singing. There's camaraderie. There's darkness. It's everything. It's everything you want. And so my episodes this week, so catch up on Hulu or NBC.com and then watch it on NBC at 8:30 and set your
DVRs.
And
we'll remind you a bunch of times on Twitter for it.
That's right.
As well. And also I'd like to sign off saying if you haven't, please go to my Twitter as there is a link. Nephew Kyle from The Ringer recorded a diss track of The Ringer Union. It appears to be very serious, where he talks about making it on his own. He references Desert Storm. And it is a 1 minute and 20 second, completely unself-aware diss track of The Ringer Union. And it is just... We're just
I wanted more specifics about like the terms of the agreement that they
the agreement.
I wanted more like specificity, like drilling down of like, here's where this side is on things and here's where I'm at. I would like more of that. But the idea that someone whose name is Nephew Kyle never had anything handed to him is something special, something to behold.
No excuses when I show up to the weigh-in, about to knock this motherfucker out the park, and I'm just playing. Came a long way from recording in the basement. Motherfuckers mad because I escaped it. What a fucking asshole.
What a fucking douchebag. Holy shit.
Oh, God. All right, we'll talk to you next time. Are you down with TTP?
Yeah, you know Lickface.
We were right, y'all. We were right. We were right. Even when it went wrong, we were right.
We were right.
We was right, y'all. We were right. So say the name. Say the name. We were right, y'all. We were right. Even when it went wrong, we were right.
Forever.